Hello, my name is Lear. I'm one of the librarians here at Teenscape. Thank you to all our participants today. So the first question is just please say your name, where you work, and how you got there in terms of, say, schooling and internships.
I'm Gretchen Laurie. I currently teach tax law, taxation law at Cal State Los Angeles in the business school. And when I went to law school in Detroit at Wayne State Law School, I was from there. When I got out of law school, I didn't like what I was doing. And actually, I was replaced by my client's son. So I went back and got a master's in tax. And that's how I ended up teaching in tax. I worked 10 years for one of the accounting firms.
Hi, everyone. My name's Beta, just like Rita, but with a B. And I went to school. I went to UCLA for college, and then I went to law school in San Francisco at Hastings. And after that, I was a public defender. And I did that for about 5 years. And after that, I became a prosecutor, and I started prosecuting lawyers who were doing bad things to their clients. And then from there, in the last 9 years, I work at the Office of Inspector General, which basically is we oversee the LA County Sheriff's Department, and we do what's called constitutional policing. So I sort of just make sure that the police are, if they shoot someone, I make sure that I go to the scene, that they're not trying to cover anything up. I have access to everything. And also, if they do, if they commit misconduct on their own time, like whether it's domestic violence or DUIs, I oversee all those cases as well. It's a neat job. And I've been doing it, like I said, for about 9 years.
Hi, my name is Danielle Tamir. I went to undergrad at Northwestern University as a theater major. I wanted to be an actress. That didn't happen. But I get to kind of, I always think that being in law is kind of like a real life theater. You're speaking in front of people, you're talking to your jury, your judge, your client. So after that, I went to law school at University of Florida. I moved here, and then I started out in family law. That had its own difficulties. So I left that, and I really wanted to do criminal law the entire time. That was my whole reason for wanting to go to law school. So I thought, why am I trying to do anything other than that? And I started out in a small kind of DUI practice, and then moved on to the firm I'm at now, which is Lessem, Neustadt & Toosin. It's a private criminal defense firm, so a little bit different than the public defender's office in that our clients pay for us. And it's really just been an incredible experience. Internships, I interned at the Alachua County Sheriff's Office, Alachua County District Attorney's Office in Florida in the domestic violence unit. So I tried a couple of domestic violence trials. Did an internship in Israel, working on cases under the Alien Tort Claims Act, which is a really kind of complicated piece of international law, but it's basically about terrorism and victims of terrorism. So I did that in my second year. So hello.
Hi, I'm Candace Glover. I went to college at Cal State Dominguez Hills in Carson, and then to law school, I went to UC Hastings in San Francisco. When I was in law school, I interviewed my last year for a senior clerk position in the public defender's office. And of all the interviews I had with firms and other agencies, the public defender's office was the place I wanted to be. I knew instantly during the course of that interview. And so I joined the public defender's office as a trial lawyer, a misdemeanor lawyer. I worked my way up. I did misdemeanors in Compton and Long Beach, downtown. Then I graduated to a felony practice where, again, in Long Beach and Compton, especially during the time of three strikes when we had clients who were facing 25 to life, I was practicing felonies in Long Beach at the time that three strikes came into being. We had tons of clients who were facing life sentences just because they stole a piece of candy or because they possessed a small amount of drugs. We did a lot of trials during that time period, and we saw a lot of people go to prison who shouldn't have gone to prison for the amount of time that they were sentenced to. I was a deputy in charge at different locations in the office, supervising misdemeanor lawyers and felony lawyers. I was a head deputy. A head deputy is the first level of management in our office. I was over juvenile operation, and Beata Shasty was one of the attorneys that worked in Juvenile East when I was in Juvenile West. I am now a assistant public defender, which simply means that we have the public defender, we have the chief deputy public defender, and then we have a group of four people at my level, assistant public defenders. I am over central operations, which means that I am the assistant over misdemeanors and felony operations for all of downtown. Probably about 250 people, more or less, are under my direct chain of supervision. It's a wonderful job. I love being a public defender. I never had any thought of working outside as a lawyer of our office. And when I retire at some point in a few years to come, I don't see myself practicing any type of other law. It's been one of the most fulfilling experiences I've ever had. And I recommend to anyone, if you're interested in a career in law, that you consider the work that we do.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Before we delve into the questions I have, does anyone have a question in the audience? We'll start. Okay. As a follow-up to that, do you allow, or where you work allows, teens and or adults to shadow for a day or intern or anything of that sort, either high school or college or adult? And we can share the mic if you want.
Oh, okay. I'll go first. Because I teach undergraduate students, and sometimes I've taught graduate students, so I don't really have students shadow me, but I'm certainly open to students sitting in my class. Now, as far as law go, tax law isn't the real interesting law. It wouldn't be like sitting in a trial class where you'd see people do a court case. But I really like talking to students about getting a career in law and that and their aspects, because it's more than just what you see on television.
I would say in my work, no, we don't, only because part of my job is to attend a lot of meetings with the Sheriff's Department, and as you may know, a lot of we discuss a lot of personnel issues, and those are currently under California law not disclosable. They are secret. And you may have heard that there was a law that was recently passed that is trying to make those things public. But until that happens, because of the nature of the meetings and the discussions that we have, it's very difficult for us to have anybody shadow us. We have had some interns just in our office, but I would not say that's very exciting, because really the fun part of my job is to go out in the field, and so unfortunately, not really.
We've had a couple of interns, mostly college age, and you know, they immediately start, you know, doing some stuff like the stuff that we don't have time to do, like redacting, which is if our client has the right to get the reports and stuff that revolve around his case. However, we're not, pursuant to law, allowed to disclose the names and addresses of witnesses, things like that. So they can get a copy of it, but what we have to do before that is redact it, which means sit with every sheet of paper with a black marker and black out all the names and all the addresses of all the witnesses, or, you know, things like that. And that's not fun. So we have our interns do that. As far as, you know, walking around day to day, you know, I mean, you can, the great thing about court about the courthouses and courtrooms is they're open to the public. You can kind of walk in and, except for some very kind of, some small, you know, exceptions where possibly minors are involved and they close the courtroom, you can walk in and watch kind of like an arraignment proceeding happen in the audience. It seems very glamorous, but a lot of times there's a lot of numbers and things just getting thrown around, and it happens very quickly, and it happens in a way that it's kind of like, unless you know what's going on, you're like, what's just happened? Because a lot of people have to go through the system every single day, but you can always go to the courthouse and take a look.
We do encourage students, high school students, to come and chat to us. We do work with the Constitutional Rights Foundation, and one of their programs is a two-week, maybe in the summertime, I think. Maybe it's a little bit longer than that, but we've had students come through that program, and they'll work a couple of weeks with us, and we'll have them do some clerical work, some work connected with the cases that we prepare. We've had kids who come in and, you know, not even just high school students, but college students, people who are interested in going to law school, and we'll pair them up with someone who works in the courtroom and, you know, kind of take them around. And what we'd like to do is, you know, I mean, we want people to learn about the work that we do. And what we are really interested in doing as well is see if we can get or develop awareness or interest in the work that we do at an early age. So at the age that you all are now, before you even get to college, before you even get to law school, it'd be great if, you know, you found an interest. And if you are interested in the work that we do, we would encourage you to contact our office. And it may very well be that you'll see something, you'll have an experience where, you know, you figure out this is what you want to do. And, you know, that'd be great.
Can I add one thing? I just want to say that, you know, how when I was in high school, I was always interested in criminal stuff. I liked watching stuff about like serial killers. I was really into just, you know, my mom's a little worried about me.
That's the same for me.
That's true for me too.
But at some point, I actually just, when I was in high school, I went to, at that time, I don't know if Santa Monica criminal courts are still there or not. Okay. So I just went there and I just said, can I do anything to help? I want to sit in a courtroom and watch murder trials. And they actually found me a spot. And, you know, I helped, I think, the clerk do some paperwork while I watched all these amazing murder trials happen for an entire summer. And I was absolutely fascinated. And that's really how I got into criminal law as my interest, and which led ultimately to, you know, law school a few years later. But I do think you can find opportunities if you're interested by literally just walking in. I mean, I had no counselor guide me. I just walked in. I was like, can I do anything here? Because I want to sit in a courtroom and watch what the lawyers do. So
I did that right after college. I volunteered at the public defender's office. This is before I even took the LSAT. I said, I want to make sure that I want to do this. And I volunteered at the public defender's office in multiple parts of it, the juvenile section. And then they kind of moved me over to like felony intake, and intake being, you know, we interview the clients after they've, you know, at least gone through their arraignment, and we kind of talked to them. And yeah, that was where I decided, yes, this is exactly what I want to be doing. So yeah, definitely volunteer.
Okay, and to follow up on that, because everyone is so unique on the panel today, I usually do a what's a day in the life, but what's a week in the life? Because I know your weeks take you all over the place.
For me, mine changes each semester, but I'm always teaching what's called individual taxation. And maybe you haven't, but you will at some point file your own tax return. I teach my students their very first tax class is individual taxation. So I have two classes where I teach that every semester. And then my other class is what's called corporation tax. and I teach that twice. So I'm in the classroom four times a week, and I do office hours to talk to students. And then a lot of my time I spend writing, because I'm supposed to, as a professor, write papers, and they're on tax issues. But I love it. I love being in the classroom. It just happened to be that way. I didn't think I'd fall into tax law. Most attorneys, I don't know if it's true for the rest of you, don't like tax. So you never know how you think you're not good at math. And when I said my job, I lost my job, I fell into tax, and I love it. So you just never know. So that's my week.
So I think if you're going to be a lawyer, there's a couple of things that I think you have to kind of be into, and one is reading and one is writing. So a typical week for me, my job I feel like is more like a reporter now, because what I basically do is I find information by talking to people in the sheriff's department, whether it be, you know, about some policy that they have that I think is harmful to the public, or any sort of internal policies that they have that, you know, revolves around misconduct. But on a typical week, what I do is I talk to people. I go to a lot of meetings, and I'm on the phone. I do email. And once I gather up all my facts, I then start to do more intense research about kind of what I want to put in a report. And then I write a lot. So, and that was actually one of the things that led me to law school. When I was in college, I had a lot of professors who were telling me, "You're really good. You're a good writer," you know, and I was a political science major. So there was really only two paths for people who become poli sci majors. You're either going to be a teacher or professor, or you're going to go to law school. So I sort of ended up in law school. It's really just sort of about collaborating with people in your office and people in the sheriff's department to get the information that you need so that you can write a report. And most of our reports are public and on our website, so you can take a look and see the kind of things that we look at. So, yeah, that's a typical week.
So, in private criminal defense, we're taking cases kind of all over the place. Mostly I'm out of Ventura and Santa Barbara. So in a given week, I'm in Ventura Court and Santa Barbara Court a lot. I know our LA County counterparts are in courtrooms all over LA County all week. It is every day you're in court. You're there for everything from like a quick first appearance where you just enter a plea of not guilty. You get the discovery, which is all the evidence that, or at least the first packet of evidence that they're going to give you, and you know, go to the next one. To full-blown, you know, hearings, big evidentiary hearings, big preliminary hearings, which are, we'll leave it there. It's a part of a felony case. So a given week, I'm in court most mornings, some afternoons as well. In between, there's going to be phone calls to clients, updating them. They're going to ask you questions. They're going to want to talk to you for hours about all kinds of things. And sometimes I also feel like you're also a social worker. You know, you're dealing with really, really intense emotional things. And besides just representing our clients, we also kind of listen to them and talk to them because they're in a really stressful situation. So a lot of my time is spent on the phone, calling people, talking to them, updating them on their cases. And then there's also a lot of writing and reading and researching, writing motions. On the defense side, you know, you're on the attack. You're constantly trying to, all right, how did they get this evidence? All right, is there a problem with the way the police got this evidence? All right, I'm going to file a motion on it, and I'm going to research all about, Fourth Amendment, you know, search and seizure stuff. Going to write a motion, going to file that. We're going to have a hearing on it, and I'm going to try to get this evidence out. And that happens a lot. Before trials happen, you have to write trial briefs. Some people do, some people don't, but you write trial briefs. So there's a lot of reading, there's a lot of writing, there's a lot of keeping up with research. So that's a week.
We'll take a question.
You know, it's interesting that the work that I used to do in a courtroom when I was a courtroom attorney, I really just had to focus on my clients. So I would try cases in front of juries, write motions, argue motions, visit clients in custody, meet with witnesses and experts. But it's interesting that that work or what I did doesn't translate into the work that I do now, because I'm an executive manager now. And at the level that I'm at now, it's my interest or my work with operations is more about making sure that we have the right staffing. So I participate and I help interview and hire clerical staff and lawyers and student professional workers. We have a budget of about $220 million more or less, and part of that budget is goes towards attorney salaries or employee salaries. And we have about a staff of almost 1,100 people. You know, you're trying to service or provide service to all of LA County. Any individual who's been charged with a misdemeanor or a felony in LA County, if you're indigent, if you're poor and you can't afford your own attorney, then the public defender's office will represent you. That translates into representations of hundreds of thousands of people. So, or cases, should I say. It's more than just making sure that, you know, we have the right staffing or we have enough staffing, but also looking at how can we improve service to our clients and to our communities. You know, what new statutes or what new law is going to help us to help our clients in a different way. I go to meetings all the time, so we meet with other, you know, stakeholders in the criminal justice arena who may not have the same interest and that I do. I go for the benefit of my clients and our clientele. There are judges there who represent the courtroom or the courts. There are prosecutors. There are people from other county departments, other city departments. Everybody has an interest in, you know, in the work that we do. So we spend a lot of time in meetings. I spend a lot of time meeting with people outside of the office, inside the office. I work on projects. I think one of the best things about the job that I'm in now is you can identify what you think is important and you can work on that. If there's a change in the law, like next week I have a meeting where there's a group that wants to work on this Senate Bill 823, which provides for those people who are convicted of offenses that are nonviolent, and if you were the victim of human trafficking, you can petition to get your case dismissed. So we have a lot of clients in the past who were convicted of different offenses because they were victims of human trafficking, and they did certain things because of that. So, you know, since there have been so many changes in the law that assist people now, we have to look at that group of individuals that we represented who may fit that criteria, and if we are able to show that they were in fact victims of human trafficking, we can go back and we can petition to get their conviction set aside. So there's the ability to kind of figure out what's important to your clients, to communities, to work on those projects and to try and bring relief to people who qualify. It's, like I said, it's really great work, and it's very freeing in that, you know, it's great to work in the courtroom, but I think it's also great to work where in work that you're not just helping one individual person. You know, you could help groups and groups of people at the level that I'm at. So that's, I love that.
You had a question, sir?
Yeah, I was curious to know, you had mentioned that sometimes trial briefs aren't prepared, and I was a little curious to know what case would that be then?
I mean, it depends on the attorney. Some attorneys kind of for civil cases, trial briefs are prepared, and that's something that happens and goes to the judge. But you know, for a criminal case, sometimes people don't necessarily need them. They have their own way of doing it. I'm kind of anal, and I have everything in a small compartmentalized way for me to see. So that's just me. So I don't know.
And usually, what does that brief consist of?
So I mean, it's going to include the theory of the case, the facts, the witnesses that are going to be called, the evidence that you're going to be presenting, you know, kind of like a list of the evidence. Exhibit A is this, exhibit B is this, exhibit C is this. that kind of stuff.
What do you mean by the theory of the case?
The theory of the case. So when you're a defense attorney, every case you have is kind of a story. It's a story, and you're telling that story, and there's a theory behind it. For example, good theory of the case would be, you can't always get what you want or something, and you're some kind of, that was one that was a theory of a case I did in the prosecutor's office, where I was on the prosecutor's side. I was sitting second chair, and it was a domestic violence case. And it was a case where this incident happened because the individual didn't get what he wanted. And so our theory was, you can't always get what you want. And, this is why this person should be punished, because you don't get to behave this way when you don't get what you want. So that's kind of the theory of the case. That's what I would put in the trial brief. I don't know if anybody else can.
It sounds like it's a matter of explaining the rationale and justification for what your laying out your case for. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what trial brief would to be.
Thank you so much. Any other questions so far? Oh, everyone's really quiet today. Okay. Moving on. What kind of technology and platforms do you use? And how comfortable does one need to be with technology?
Prior to teaching, I worked at the accounting firm KPMG, because when you're a tax attorney, you can either work in a business setting like an accounting firm, or you can work in a law firm, or you can teach in a business school or a law school. So I was going to say, when I was working in an accounting firm, the main things I did was research and writing. So I had to be really familiar with how to find tax law, how to find a case, and how to write it, but also to know how to explain it in plain English. So those, I think, for me, even now, the big thing was learning how you do a Google search. I do that in the legal setting. If I need to know this particular definition, I know how to do it and find the information. So that's the biggest thing for me, besides typing. So mine's more research that I have to do, use software to do research.
Whoops, there goes all my thoughts. So I would not say that technology is huge in what I do. It's okay.
Oh,
yeah. It's great. Yeah, it's fine. I use the internet, I use email, and I do research on Lexis, which is a program that you learn. It's a research-based, a legal research computer program that they teach you how to use in law school. When I went to law school, showing my age, we still use books for research too. I'm not sure they teach that anymore. I'm not sure they have books anymore.
They did, and I was wondering why they were, because they also taught us Westlaw. So I'm like, why are we learning this?
So I would say the one area that I need to probably get better skills at would be PowerPoint and Excel. Those are things that I use a lot, because I do presentations and different panels, and I don't know how to use Excel at all, but I just found out that the LA County Library has a teaching thing that you can watch. So I'm really excited. We had somebody from the library yesterday and gave out library cards, and I'm so excited to use the resources that I did not know were available. But you all probably know more technology than I do sitting right now, so I think you'll be fine once you get to your careers.
Can I add, because I work with tax attorneys and accountants and stuff. I never had to prepare tax returns, but the people I worked with, when they came out of school, even law school, they did tax returns. They had to learn how to do software to do tax returns. So that's a big part of what happens with tax attorneys.
Oh. You're not in a technological field, but certain tools will help you do your job faster. Adobe PDF stuff, learning how to work in PDFs. I do a lot of, I've like have to turn OCR, like text recognition on PDFs, because a lot of the discovery that you're getting is a PDF. And if you want to quickly search through 200 pages or 300 pages of police reports, if you do an OCR, you can suddenly like type in a thing and oh, I'm looking for the report or the interview with so-and-so. So I type in so-and-so's name, you can find it. And you can do that with a PDF. I didn't know how to do that with a PDF, but I learned. So working with Adobe is really important. We do a lot of cloud-based storage, so working with Dropbox, working on Dropbox Business, things like that, being able to, you know, manage files on the cloud. We use a it's like an online database filing system called Clio. A lot of attorneys are starting to use that now as well. So it's pretty straightforward, user-friendly. If you know how to use the internet and you know how to use, you know, basic things, you'll be able to figure it out pretty quickly. And we're not in the tech field, so.
You know, we use Excel too. I'm not that conversant in it either, so I have to learn, but a lot of information, I mean, we're trying to gather a lot of data from systems, so from the court system, from our own system, and oftentimes that information will come from in the form of a spreadsheet. We'll get data from the California Department of Corrections, and we'll have to figure out, and that spreadsheet will be dumped into a database. So in our practice now, I mean, you're going to have to be more tech savvy than we've ever been. We're getting a new case management system, which we're going to have to wrestle with. And the court is now, in LA County, they are updating and getting a new case management system as well. We do have a lot of, you know, documents that we deal with in PDF form and try and turn that from a PDF into a Word document that's fillable. We use Box as well. I'm not very tech savvy, but I find that, you know, I have to learn, because if you're going to get access to the data that you need, you're going to have to, you have to be more sophisticated when it comes to tech.
I do want to add, learning how to do effective search terms and how to search well is a good skill to have, especially when you're doing research, because, you know, crafting a good search query inside Westlaw will save you hours and hours and hours of time. So, you know, if you can search really well and really efficiently, and you know what to look for and how to look for things, you'll be a better researcher. So definitely learn how to do effective searches.
Yes. Let's take questions. Here, let me give you the mic.
It's actually, anybody can answer is, do you have any worries whether tech might, you know, take away certain jobs in the law practice? Like, since there has been a recent advancement in technology, that's what they say, but, and it's been taking a lot of jobs, so I was wondering if that could also take some jobs from the law practice, yeah.
Does anyone want to tackle that one?
You know, there is software now that they're developing that will allow, for expungement purposes, right? So let's say that a person was convicted of an offense that they can petition the court to have it set aside and dismissed. Normally, I mean, oftentimes we have lawyers who will search the penal code or whatever code section it is and do the research and figure it out as to whether or not the person qualifies. But now there is software that lay people can use to provide the same service, and they feed the information into the software or into, you know, the system, and the system kicks back an analysis as to whether or not the person is eligible or not. I don't see that kind of software taking the place of individuals. I mean, because you still have to have a lawyer review it, but we use paralegals oftentimes, you know, to do a lot of that work. And if there's more reliance on systems to do the analysis, then, I mean, you still need lawyers to go into the courtrooms and argue cases to represent clients, but it'll be interesting to see how this moves forward. I mean, I don't know how I feel about the reliance on that kind of software alone to make a determination as to whether or not a person gets relief or not. But I was really surprised when I became aware that that kind of software is, you know, existing, and I'm sure changes and developments or modifications are being made all the time. So.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of law is based on, you know, rules and laws and legal codes, and, you know, a lot of times you can easily feed those things in, but I think that there is a certain level of human element in law, and the human element of, at least in litigation, when you're in a courtroom and you're talking to people, making a connection with a jury, or, you know, showing some kind of passion in front of a judge and making an impassioned argument. There's like a certain finesse and art form to it that I don't think can ever be replaced by a machine. So I don't know. That's my romanticized take on it.
I don't think that there's anything that can take over in my field, but technology has had a huge impact in what I do, in the sense that anytime now that a police officer is doing something bad, it's on video, it's on a cell phone. There's all sorts of cameras now inside the jails because of those videos that came out in the last, you know, 10 years, where police are not treating people in a very nice way. So although technology has not had a direct impact on what the kind of thing that I do, it has had a huge impact on how we conduct business. So.
For me, I guess the teaching aspect, we're switching, and I haven't done it because I like the interconnection with the students, is doing online and that kind of thing. But like the other ladies echoed, is there, unless intelligence, a computer changes where they can quickly argue in front of a judge or sitting next to a client and responding quickly to an argument, because you have to think about, oh, this person has said this, what's my counter argument? I think technology at this point can't replace that. And I don't know if clients would really want to talk to a machine, per se. I mean, that sounds kind of glib, but especially, you know, the fees you're charging. Like my boss, when I worked at KPMG, his hourly rate 10 years ago was $600 an hour. And, you know, I guess you could have a machine that's charging similar, but you probably, for that money, you want a connection more.
Oh, yes.
I wanted to know how you have a very stressful job, and sometimes we as the public don't know all the specific details of certain cases. How do you deal with, you know, there's sometimes we only hear the little blurb of horrific cases or whatever it might be. How do you deal with that stress personally on your level so you don't take it home?
Being a tax attorney, I don't have a lot of stress, but we did have stress in the sense of being on time with what a client wants and deadlines. But I do know from what they did, I did intern 2 years at a prosecutor's office, and my husband previously was a public defender. It can reach a point where you may get out of that area. I think with criminal law, there's a lot more in that sense, because I can still picture pictures in my head that I saw of people being beat. It can wear on you, and not sure totally. Some people, like my husband, knew he would have to get out of being a public defender. He couldn't do that forever. But I think it's kind of the stairs. I guess you kind of leave it at work. You should, to a certain extent. But I don't know.
You probably all have more stressful jobs than I do.
You know, when I was a public defender the first 5 years of my career, I would say that that's how it was for me. I took it home. And I was really invested in the outcome of the cases because these were my clients. And I actually think the lawyers that are successful in being a public defender are the ones that can leave it at work. And when I say successful, I mean that it wears you down. If I was in trial, I was, you know, preparing till 2 a.m. and then up at 6. And if I, you know, if I really believed my client was innocent, it was even worse because I was the only thing standing between their freedom. And so it was a lot of pressure. In my current job, the stress is, you know, it's difficult. I have to get up at 2 or 3 in the morning if there's a shooting by a deputy, and I have to go see, you know, the scene, and it's late at night, and it's, you know, a dead body. And that's somehow I can deal with that a little bit easier because there's a layer of distance. I'm not representing, you know, anybody. So I'm just overseeing that they are, you know, doing their job right. So it's, I have to say, that was part of the reason why I think I am fessing this up in front of my very first supervisor. It was part of why I left was because I could not separate. Mental health is important. And it was really, really difficult. And I knew some public defenders who were able to do that as soon as they left, and I envied them. But so you have to just see who you are as a person. You know, there's no shame in it. It's just like if you're very attuned and sensitive, it's going to be a little bit harder for you to disengage, which you really need to do as a criminal defense attorney to have some sanity.
I didn't do criminal most of my career, but I did work in mergers and acquisitions, and we represented always the buyer, and you knew they were buying targets and people would lose their job. And so mentally at times I would think about that, but to be honest, you kind of had to separate that. But also we weren't meeting the individual people who were losing their job. You focused on the client and getting, so it is hard. I mean, you do kind of have to separate yourself. I wonder for you all if having other people that are attorneys, it helps, because I think it helped my husband to have me. I didn't do the kind of law I did, but he could talk to me about it.
I'm still pretty fresh into doing this. You know, I've been barred since, you know, 2014. So, and I think I'm still in the place of taking it home. And, I cry. I come home and my husband has held me and I've cried. And it's okay to cry. I've screamed into a pillow. And that's okay too. You got to take your time and be kind to yourself. And I think the one thing that I have to consistently tell myself is, it's not your fault. None of what's happening is your fault. You're doing the best you can. And, you know, there's systems around you and things in place that are greater than you. And sometimes you can't always help. But you are helping, you know, and I keep, you know, I tell myself that a lot, you know, you're doing something. It doesn't always work out, but sometimes it does. And that's what makes it worth it. I would also say, make sure you have outlets, hobbies, friends, go out, see your families, your spouses, your partners, your children, your cat. I do art, and a lot of times that's really helpful. There's ways of coping, but you can't not cry sometimes.
When I was in felony trials, I don't think I managed it that well. You know, I mean, I remember going out to, on this one murder case, I mean, I had to track these crack houses where my client was being held hostage. And, you know, you find in the work, too, you have to figure out when's the best way you can go, at time you can go. I mean, we'd go to neighborhoods where, you know, a lot of things were happening. And, you know, yeah, we had investigators, but, you know, you have to make connections with people. You got to talk to people. You have to go into their homes. You know, you have to get them to talk to you. So, and the backdrop is, you know, you're in trial and you can't get a continuance and you need this witness. And your client is dependent on you. I remember, I think I developed high blood pressure as a result of the work because I would ruminate. I would think about it all the time. And you're operating at such a high level. You know, you have a caseload full of cases. And I know what B is talking about because we all experienced it. You know, you can't help but take the work home because these are people, you know, and every single person that I encountered, every one of my clients would say, you know, Ms. Glover, I need your help. I need you to help me. You know, I mean, they're desperate. These people are incarcerated, you know, they need something to happen. And you know, you feel a real responsibility to them. So it was hard, I think, in felony trials. It's not until I got to this job that I figured out how important it is to do other things. So now, with the help of Libby through Overdrive, I joined the city library and the county library. I listen to books on the way to work, on the way home, because it's like an hour and a half each way, and I don't think about the work the way that I used to, you know, and I wish I had learned this earlier on. But having that time where you're not focused on all the things that are going to greet you when you walk in the door, all the things that people need. I mean, it's not the same stress as representing clients in trial who are looking at prison, but now it's about, you know, somebody's about to be held in contempt, or, you know, there's a flood at the courthouse, or, you know, there's an earthquake and we can't get in. I mean, there are things now that are not the same as what I was dealing with before. But listening to books, to audio books, when I get to work, you know, whatever. So.
Thank you. Yes, question. I'll repeat it. You don't have to get, oh, all right.
Okay. So I was wondering, all you women, so there's a question that I have been wondering. When pursuing your career, have you faced any discrimination or situation because you were women? And do you believe that nowadays are those problems like getting better or getting worse for women in the workforce?
I'd like to touch on that one as well and follow up with an additional, do you see more diversity in your workplace as opposed to before?
I was trying to think. I never did when I was at KPMG, and it's a huge accounting firm, and it's around the world, but it is mostly men. And I always kind of wondered, and I never was put into an awkward position as a woman. I never felt that way. The only funny thing, and I ended up, one of my co-workers, I spoke to her about it. I got married, and one of my coworkers who was my age said, oh, you'll be probably having children now. And that was the only time I ever felt, but he actually said a lot of inappropriate things at times. Like he described one of my coworkers as light in the loafers, if you recognize what that phrase is. But I did talk to somebody and about that. I didn't go above, so I felt pretty lucky. I haven't had that because my mom was a legal secretary, so I knew that, you know, it's a very male dominated, and I feel like I've been lucky. And even my mother, as a legal secretary, never felt that she was put into an awkward position. I do think, I think it is different now in the sense, like when I went to law school, you know, my classmates generally are probably used to being in school with women. I think that can make a difference. And also, I'll give you this too. At KPMG, partners were forced out to retire at a certain age. And so, like, the people I worked were like my age or younger. So I think the ideas were different about women.
My field is very diverse. When I started out as a public defender, there was an equal amount of men and women, I think, and very diverse backgrounds. I guess sometimes I felt like some judges that were like older, whiter, were maybe a little bit tougher on the women lawyers, but I took that as a challenge to better myself. As far as, you know, if he was picking on me when I was trying to pick my jury and telling me, you can't ask that question, you know, I would try to make sure that, you know, I knew exactly what I was doing so that if he, you know, if they came at me, if he, you know, started kind of telling me to tone it down, that I could, you know, tell him I don't have to, and this is my job. Interestingly, in my current job, because I work with police, majority of them, it's a very male-dominated profession. There's not that many women in management at the police department, and I deal a lot with the management. And so there is definitely culturally, you can tell that they have a hard time sometimes with a woman telling them, you know, that they're not doing their job well or right. And you have to kind of overcome that and get them to listen to you. So it's always challenging. But you know what? As a lawyer, a lot of what you do is you're advocating for your position. And so you're always trying to convince people to think the way to get them to think a certain way. So I look at it as a challenge. But yes, there's undertones across, I think, the profession that where you still have women having to, I think, work a little bit harder to get into management and work a little bit harder to gain the same respect that I think is kind of automatically given a little bit easier to men. So.
Even though I said about being a woman, I have an issue. I do think there is an issue with diversity, ethnic diversity, especially depending, like in an accounting firm setting where I worked at KPMG, hopefully it's gotten better because they do have a CEO of it who's a woman. That's a different issue, having minorities, people of color, and that in that setting. I don't know if it's the experience here, but it seems like in government jobs, diversity is a lot better.
Well, I mean, I haven't really been able to track a shift for very long because, again, 2014. But as a woman, yeah, I've definitely had situations where a client will call me sweetie. I've had situations where the bailiff asks me to step behind the bar, which is, there's like in every courtroom, there's kind of a little swingy door, and that's the bar, and you can go past it if you're an attorney. So most of the time you just walk in, check in with the clerk, you know, you go ahead and go on your merry way. And I've had, you know, bailiffs say, step behind the bar, ma'am. And I'm like, I'm an attorney, I'm checking in with the clerk. Oh, you're an attorney? Yes, I am. I've had situations where I've been mistaken for the secretary. Oh, I thought you were the secretary. Nope. I'm short and a woman, but I am an attorney. I even now I felt that a couple of times. The worst is when the clients call you something and like sweetie or honey, and you know, they're also your client, and you know, you just kind of take a minute. Okay. And then you keep going. You can't address it. You know, you can't. As far as, diversity is concerned, you know, I've seen many different backgrounds amongst the attorneys that I've worked with, against, for. So that's pretty recent.
Yeah, I mean, I think with clients, you know, you spend time with them, right? And whatever ideas they have or expectations they have when they first meet you, over a period of time that they've spent with you, you know, those change, right? So I don't know that I experienced any sexism necessarily with clients or things of that sort. I mean, or maybe I just didn't pay that closely attention, you know, that close attention to it. But I do think, though, that as a woman manager supervising people, I think that I am more conscious about what I say and how I say it and what people are going to perceive when they hear it, right? I don't know that men, maybe they do spend as much time thinking about it, but I know that I think about it a lot, and I think about how I appear, because there are power dynamics, you know, and I think you're always walking a line, because you want you want people to take you seriously, you know. I mean, you have the same education that any man has that's a lawyer in our office. You went to the same schools. But I do think that you're perceived differently. And I think that you have to know that. How you deal with that and how you, you know, respond to that, I guess it's individual. But it is almost sometimes like walking a minefield, trying to navigate, you know, all the landmines that you can stumble into if you're not aware that there are perceptions out there about, you know, what you can and cannot do. So.
Thank you. We're almost out of time, but I know you had a question. Did you?
I think going back to the question about technology, there, without worrying about, I remember reading somewhere about how there's certain systems that take into account certain variables of someone who's getting convicted in terms of how likely they are to recommit a crime or whatever. So that'll sometimes determine how long their sentence will be, or the rules that
risk assessment.
Yeah, stuff like that. So it's not necessarily a question about the practice of law, but more kind of a question of law itself. What area of law is in charge of, or that overlooks the government's use of tech when it comes to stuff like that?
You know, I think you're talking about risk assessment tools, and we see it play out in when a client is arrested and being charged, and now the question is whether or not the client's going to get released. So, you know, there are tools that have been created to assist a court in determining whether or not this is someone who should get out, right? I think oftentimes, you know, people don't think about the fact that those tools can be biased, you know, and if it turns out that you're using a tool that is creating bias, then the decision that you make is going to be based upon that. You know, I have a real difficult time with these types of tools because some of the questions that they ask, I mean, there's some tools that ask about where you live and who lives in your neighborhood. Now, you don't have any control. If you are, you know, a young person, you live with your parents or you live with a family member, you have no control over where you live. But if you live in a community where there are gangs, you know, where you have family members who may be gang members, that's being held against you. That's being used against you to figure out what, you know, whether or not you're risky, whether you should be released or not, how you should be treated. So, you know, there are so many inherent problems in these tools, and I don't know how closely, you know, prosecutors and judges are looking at the problems connected with these tools. Some people think that they're better because the court uses less of its own discretion, and maybe if you rely more on this formulaic tool, then more people will get out of custody. I don't know that that's a given, you know? So there's this Senate Bill SB 10, which is in the works right now, and it was passed, and there's been some legislation now, or there's been some attempt to delay its implementation. And part of that fight has been about the use of risk assessment tools as part of the, you know, release process as to whether or not people are going to get released. And the thought is, or the hope would be, that more people would get released if this tool is used. But I don't know that that's true. I don't know that you can rely on that. And, you know, we're still in, I think, a holding pattern with respect to the use of SB 10. But, you know, if we rely too heavily on tech or on things like risk assessment tools, there's so much, I don't know, so much damage that can come as a result of that. And that's not something that we'll know until sometime later down the line. I mean, lawyers on the front lines are seeing whether or not clients are getting released from custody. But
so the area of law that is currently dealing with this and overlooking it, mm-hmm, is barely beginning to take form.
I mean, they're using it now in this in the issue of pretrial detention. I think in some other areas, back when I was in juvenile, when they're trying to figure out, I can't remember. I mean, I know that I've seen it in other aspects of her work, and there's something else too. I mean, something called a MMPI, which is a personality test, and those results from those types of tests are used to determine whether or not the client is dangerous or antisocial. And I've seen prosecutors using those type of tests, you know, to make arguments with respect to, you know, your client should be treated differently because, you know, they scored high on these types of tests. And essentially, they're personality tests, you know. So, you know, we'll see how this plays out, but there are, I guess, factions that believe that, you know, if you rely on these types of tests, then you take a lot of the discretion out, so therefore the results are going to be more fair. But I don't think you can say that. I don't think you know that. I don't know that we've seen that.
Well, thank you so much. We're out of time, but did you have one quick question?
Yeah, it's just the business time, like, they use considered to your family, so consider it as a prosecutor.
So to recap, have you had anything dangerous or anything you've had to look out for?
I mean, you may not think of it, but I had a student this year who did not like the grade I gave him. No, I'm serious. It was very, very bad, and to the point where I do feel physically, even today, that I could be threatened by him. So it's just not in the criminal setting. But fortunately, when I was at KPMG, I never felt that way because I didn't have to deal with that. But you could have people at work, but your guy's situation is very different.
Well, I don't know if you remember a few years ago, there was an LAPD guy that went around and shot his former captain because he had been fired from the police department. So, because I'm involved in the discipline process, at the sheriff's department, there's always a little bit of a concern that there's a person that is disgruntled and has been fired. You know, I think I never really thought about it until that incident happened, where he went around and killed a few people. And we have had some people on blogs, some police officers that make comments about us and what we do and how we're basically, you know, firing people, which we're really not. We ultimately, the sheriff's department makes that decision. But yeah, I mean, you worry that there's somebody who has a gun, you know, legally walking around and could follow you home or something. So, I mean, I don't really worry about it, but I think it's just you're always cautious because you're dealing with, you know, anybody that is unhappy that they got fired can come after you. So,
I mean, we've had some threats at our office sometimes. They're usually unfounded, but I mean, always unfounded. We've never had an issue. But, you know, we're dealing, again, high emotions. Sometimes people don't like what the outcome of their case is or, you know, and you know, not angels a lot of the time, but, you know, sometimes you get a threat here and there and it's kind of par for the course. You just kind of are like, all right, it's cool, buddy. Thanks. And then you move on. I think it's just par for the course sometimes. And it's funny because I used to be, very paranoid about those things. I was a very high strung individual, and I find now I'm just kind of I've learned to just be so like water off your back, duck in the pond, water off, roll off your back, and a lot of those things. So now those things don't face me.
One thing I've learned in my practice is you treat people the way you want to be treated. You know, I think that when people spend time with you over a period of time, they they don't know you when they first meet you. I mean, our clients don't interview us and decide whether or not they're going to hire us. You know, we get appointed and we assign a lawyer, and the lawyer represents the client. So certainly there are going to be people who, you know, maybe at first blush, you know, the first couple of meetings, maybe you don't hit it off. But my experience has been, you know, you show people respect, you treat people with dignity, you know, you expect that in return, and they give it to you. And I think that when people see that you're working hard and that you treat them with respect and that you care about the work that you do, even if it turns out that the result that you get is not the result that you wanted. You know, I've had clients and I've had colleagues who have said that their clients have said to them, you know, Ms. Glover, Ms. So-and-so, Mr. So-and-so, you know, thank you for what you did for me. I know that, you know, it didn't go out the way or didn't go the way that we wanted it to go. I didn't get the not guilty or I didn't get the hang. But, you know, I mean, thank you, you know. And I think when you approach the work that way, you know, then all this other stuff, I mean, it has not been my experience that people have done that to me. You know, I've had situations where, you know, a client and I, you know, he just didn't take to me. I had one client who every single day we were in trial, he fired me or he tried to fire me, you know, and then the case hangs and, you know, he's not convicted, you know, and luckily somebody else took that case, you know, but, you know, I just think that if you are, you know, if you treat people with respect, if you treat people and you let them know that, you know, you're here because you want to be here and that you really care and you care about them as individuals and you share some of yourself, that usually doesn't, you know, factor into a concern about what's going to happen afterwards, what they're going to sue, what they're going to say, what they're going to do. Usually it just doesn't go that way.
Yeah, I just want to, I don't want anyone to get the impression that that happens a lot. For the most part, that is absolutely the case. You know, most of the time, I'd say 99% of the time, people are, you know, thank you for helping me. And, but, you know, occasionally 1%. Yeah, no, a lot of the stuff you see in like criminal dramas, it's so overblown. That kind of stuff doesn't really happen, but it has.
Well, thank you so much to the panelists for joining us on this afternoon, and thank you to the audience. Let's give panelists a round.